Okay, I'm going to start by reminding you about some familiar properties of black holes in four dimensions. So our understanding of black holes in four dimensions arises primarily from the black hole uniqueness theorems, which were a set of theorems proven in the 1970s, which have led to a complete classical description of black holes in four dimensions, at least for black holes that are isolated in the sense of being sitting on their own in empty space and in equilibrium in the sense that they've reached a time-independent equilibrium state. So the No-Hare theorems establish that any such black hole is going to be described by the Kerr solution of the Einstein equations, or if you want to include a Maxwell field, by the Kerr-Newman solution. And of course the Kerr solution on the Kerr-Newman solution has some very familiar properties. For example, it is an event horizon of spherical topology, a two-sphere. And moreover, it's uniquely determined by a small number of conserved charges. So for the Kerr solution, it's uniquely determined just by its mass and angular momentum. And in the Kerr-Newman case, one has to include also the electric and magnetic charges. So that's why we understand four-dimensional black holes. We have rigorous theorems which establish that the only such black hole essentially is Kerr, which is a very well understood solution. And hence we can claim to understand black holes at the classical level in four dimensions. In five dimensions, things are not so simple. There are two known vacuum solutions of the five-dimensional Einstein equations. So there's a class of topologically spherical black hole solutions that was constructed by Myers and Perry in 1986. So the event horizon has the topology of a three-sphere in this case. In five dimensions, their solution is a three-parameter solution. It's characterized by three conserved charges, which are the mass and two angular momenta. So in five dimensions, one has to specify two angular momenta, as should be familiar to most people. The second class of solutions was found by Emperor and myself a few years ago, and these are the black rings. So a black ring is just a black hole with topology S1 times S2, a circle times a sphere. And the reason these objects exist is they're rotating, and this rotation gives rise to a centrifugal repulsion, which prevents the ring from collapsing under its own gravity. So the rotation is in the direction of the arrow here. So this is a smaller family of solutions. This forms a two-parameter family, and it's characterized by two conserved charges, which are the mass and a single angular momentum. The other angular momentum vanishes for this solution. So the first thing we notice is that in higher dimensions, black holes do not have to be spherical, as they do in four dimensions. And secondly, it turns out that these two different objects are not always distinguished by their conserved charges. So there exist ranges for mass and angular momentum for which this object and this object carry the same conserved charges. So the No-Hare theorem simply doesn't extend to higher dimensions. And I think what this should emphasize to us is that really the No-Hare theorem is surprising. We've become kind of complacent about it, and in fact people were surprised when it wasn't true in higher dimensions. What we should be surprised by is the fact that it is true in four dimensions. So No-Hare is a very special and surprising property of four-dimensional black holes. So this discovery of black rings has raised several questions, which I've listed here. First, one might ask about the classical stability of these objects. Are they classically stable or unstable? Very little is known about this. Studying the stability of rotating black holes even in four dimensions is quite involved, and in five dimensions no one has attempted it. Secondly, what else is there? So we know about these two families of solutions, but are there any others? If so, what are the possible topologies? What else are the possibilities? We simply don't know. There are no theorems characterizing this. There might be finitely many other black holes. This might be all the possibilities. There might be infinitely many families of black holes out there. We don't know. And finally, since this is a string theory workshop, I should mention the microscopic description. It would be nice to know how string theory distinguishes between these two objects. And these are hard questions, but as we'll see today, they're rendered tractable if we add an additional requirement, namely supersymmetry. So from now on, I'm going to talk about just supersymmetric black holes. So before doing that, I'll just mention I'm going to discuss supersymmetric solutions in general. So this follows on from Jerome's talk yesterday. So if we want to understand supersymmetric black holes, we might widen the discussion and think about general supersymmetric solutions. So let's think about the simplest higher-dimensional supergravity theory, which is five-dimensional minimal supergravity. This is just Einstein-Maxwell theory with fermions. So a few years ago, Jerome, Jan Gutowski, Chris Hulst, Alice Packers, and myself were interested in understanding the general nature of supersymmetric solutions of this theory. So previously, when people constructed supersymmetric solutions, they started from some ansatz, and then asked under what circumstances did that ANSATZ admit a killing spinner. We wanted to do something more general. We wanted to understand the general nature of supersymmetric solutions. And we showed that one could do this and found that supersymmetric solutions fall into two classes. In the first class, all of the solutions have a null killing field, so these correspond to some kind of wave-like solutions. But for today's talk, I want to concentrate on the second class, in which there's a time-like killing field. And because there's a time-like killing field, one can decompose the five-dimensional metric into a time part and four spatial directions. And supersymmetry implies that these four spatial directions have to parameterize a four-dimensional hypercalor space. So the full five-dimensional metric is obtained by assembling this hypercalor space together with a scalar function, which I've called f, and the one form, which I've called omega, which describes some kind of rotation or boost, and putting them together in this way. And any supersymmetric solution in this class has this form. And not only do these functions f and omega determine the metric, they also determine the Maxwell field, and they're obtained by solving some simple-looking equations on this hypercalor space. And that's it. That's a complete description of supersymmetric solutions of that theory. So it's a considerable advance over the old approach of looking for an ansatz for the entire metric and the entire gauge field, and then trying to find a killing spinner. Here we just have to solve for a single scalar and a single one-form on your favorite hypercalor space. So it's a big reduction of the problem. And this has been generalized to various other theories, in particular to the gauge theory by Gauntless and Gutowski. And one can also add vector multiplets to either the gauge or the ungauge theory. This was done by Gutowski and myself. Let me briefly mention that one can use this formalism to construct supersymmetric black holes in anti-de Sitter space. This was done by Gutowski and myself last year in ADS5. But today we're going to concentrate on asymptotically flat black holes. So what do we know about those? So we're thinking about supersymmetric black holes in five dimensions. Well, there's one familiar example of such a black hole, the BMPV black hole. So BMPV is Breckenridge, Myers, Pete, and Vather, discovered some time ago. So this black hole has some familiar features. It's topologically spherical, so the event horizon is a three-sphere, just like the Myers-Perry black hole. It's supersymmetric, so in minimal supergravity, its mass is equal to its charge. And it turns out that for this solution, the two angular momenta are always equal. So it's a two-parameter solution in minimal supergravity. Now you might ask, what else is there? What other black holes are there beyond BMPV? And a partial answer to this question was provided by a paper I wrote a few years ago, based on this supersymmetric classification. So what I managed to show is that if there exists any other supersymmetric black hole in minimal supergravity, then the near horizon geometry of that black hole must be ADS3 times S2, and in particular the horizon geometry must be S1 times S2. In other words, it must be a black ring. So any other black hole apart from BMPV has to be a black ring. That's all the possibilities. I should say at the time I didn't think this was possible because I thought I had an argument that excluded it. And that's what I said in my paper. But then a couple of papers appeared by Boehner and Krauss and Boehner, who conjectured that supersymmetric black rings should indeed exist. And in particular, Josef Boehner constructed a supersymmetric black string solution, an infinitely extended black string, which he argued should describe the infinite radius limit of a black ring. So following the appearance of those papers, I went back to my paper and spotted a mistake, and this is now the correct statement. So this is a fairly strong result. So remember, in the non-supersymmetric case, we haven't got a clue what kinds of black hole exist. Here in the supersymmetric case, we know there are at most two types of black hole. There's the BMPV black hole, and there are black rings, and that's it. Those are the only possibilities. And this can also be extended to include vector multiplets. This was done by Gutowski. And this paper should be of interest to anyone who's interested in, for example, the attractor mechanism for black rings. Okay, so supersymmetric black rings might exist, do they? Well, the answer is yes, of course. So first examples were found by the Fellowship of the Ring here. We were working in minimal supergravity with this formalism for finding supersymmetric solutions that I've just described. So we took some ANSATZ to solve those equations that I mentioned for F and omega. The hypercalor space here is flat space, by the way, so it's pretty simple. And following the appearance of these solutions of minimal supergravity, they were rapidly generalized to more complicated theories. In particular, a natural thing to do is to include vector multiplets, since that's what you get by toroidal reduction from higher dimensions. And this was done simultaneously by three groups. First was Boehner and Warner, second was us, and then Gauntlet and Gutowski. And these papers are all interesting in complementary ways. So I think the Boehner-Warner approach to actually constructing the solutions is the most physical approach. Our paper probably gives the most detailed analysis of the solutions. And the papers by Gauntlet and Gutowski are interesting because their formalism allows them to construct solutions describing multiple rings, multiple concentric rings. So there are further generalizations of this idea that one can consider. So later on, we'll hear about nutty rings from Gandalf and non-BPS rings by Frodo. Who am I? Well, that's for my collaborators to decide. Okay, so let me describe some properties of these solutions. So these are supersymmetric, they preserve four supersymmetries, so they're 1/8 BPS objects, just like the BMPV black hole. There are three killing fields, there's time translations, there's rotations around the S1 of the ring's horizon, and then the azimuthal angle on the S2 is also a killing field. So the isometric group is abelian, which is in contrast with the BMPV black hole, for example, which is a non-abelian isometry group. One slightly surprising aspect of these solutions is that they carry two angular momenta. So remember, I told you that the non-supersymmetric black ring, the original black ring, only had one angular momentum. But here we find that both components of angular momenta, both angular momenta, are non-vanishing. And moreover, they're never equal. So the angular momentum around the circle is always greater than the angular momentum on the sphere. And that means that one can always distinguish the supersymmetric black ring from the BMPV solution just by looking at the conserved charges, because BMPV has two equal angular momenta. So if you're worried about the issue of non-uniqueness messing up the entropy calculation for BMPV, you don't have to worry, because those two solutions can be distinguished by their conserved charges. The angular velocities of the black ring vanish. This is a general feature true for any supersymmetric asymptotically flat black hole, as pointed out by Gauntlet, Myers and Townsend. And the near horizon geometry of the black ring is ADS3 times S2, as I've already mentioned. So to understand the microscopic structure of black rings, it's important to understand what kind of charges they carry. So to do that, let's think about an M-theory description. We can reduce M-theory on a 6-torus to get and truncate to get a supergravity theory in 5 dimensions with gauge group U1 cubed. So there are 3 Maxwell fields. So we're in this situation of minimal supergravity coupled to vector multiplets that I've been describing. So the charges under these 3 U1s come from M2 brains wrapped on the 6-torus in different ways. So one can wrap M2 brains on 3 different cycles of the 6-torus, as I've shown here, in a supersymmetric manner. And that gives rise to 3 charges, Q1, Q2, Q3, under these 3 U1s. And those 3 charges are carried by our black ring, and indeed these 3 charges are also carried by the BMPV solution. What's new for the black ring is that it also has M5 brain charges. So if one takes an M5 brain, one can wrap 4 of its world volume directions on the torus, and that gives you a black string in 5 dimensions, and then you can take a black string and form it into a loop. And that loop is going to be the loop of our ring. So we've got an M5 string, if you like, forming a loop. And once again, we can do that in 3 different ways. We can wrap it on the torus in 3 different ways, with all 3 types of M5 brain sharing a common direction around the loop, which I'll parameterize by some coordinate psi. And I'll call the number of 5 brains of each type little q1, little q2, little q3. Now, the M2 brain charges here are clearly conserved. They'll just be given by standard flux integrals of the 3 Maxwell fields at infinity in 5 dimensions. And these are clearly conserved charges. But the 5 brain charges are not conserved. And that's because these 5 brains are formed into a contractible loop. There's nothing to stop this loop shrinking down to 0 size and vanishing. So the 5 brain charges are not conserved. These little q's are not conserved. They're merely dipoles. And you can measure them as follows. So here's our loop, parameterized by psi. We can take a 2-sphere that links that loop in 5 dimensions. And then you calculate psi, sorry, you calculate q, just as a flux integral of the Maxwell fields over that 2-sphere. And you see that's not a conserved charge, because if this loop shrinks to 0 size, then there is no 2-sphere, so this object isn't really defined. So we have three conserved charges given by the big Qs and three dipole non-conserved charges given by the little Qs. And the general supersymmetric black ring solution is specified by seven parameters, which are the three conserved charges, the three dipole charges, and a parameter analogous to a radius for the ring. So roughly speaking, it sets the size of this loop. So it's a seven-parameter solution. We can compare that with BMPV. The BMPV solution only has four parameters. So this is a much larger family of supersymmetric black holes than was known previously. Now, so we have a seven-parameter solution, but the solution carries only five conserved charges. So the five conserved charges are the three big Qs, the three M2 brain charges, and the two angular momenta, J psi and J phi. The mass isn't an independent conserved charge because we've got a saturated BPS equality here. So we have more parameters to specify the solution than we have conserved charges. So if we just specify the conserved charges, we still have freedom to continuously vary some of the parameters. So we have a continuous violation of black hole uniqueness. There's a continuously infinite family of solutions with the same conserved charges. And this is a much worse violation of black hole uniqueness than the one I started off telling you about, where we had just a black ring and a Myers-Torrey black hole with the same charges. There we just had a discrete non-uniqueness. Here we have a continuous infinity of solutions with the same charges. And in fact, this has previously been seen for the non-BPS rings in a paper by Emperan on dipole rings last year. At the quantum level, of course, these charges are not going to be continuous, but they'll be quantized brain numbers, and this renders this continuous violation of black hole uniqueness finite, but nevertheless, it can still be large. If the charges are large, then there can be an arbitrarily large violation of black hole uniqueness. And this is kind of the new feature that arises for black rings. So the question now is, how do we account for this non-uniqueness in any string theory calculation of black hole entropy? This is an entirely new feature that's never been seen before for supersymmetric black holes. And I think this will be described in Legolas's talk. in a moment. David is editing his talk. Okay, so that so far I've been talking just about the M-theory description of black rings, but it's also interesting to mention the 2B description, because it's more common to discuss black holes in string theory using the 2B description. If we dualize the solution to a 2B solution, then these conserved charges, the big Qs, become charges associated with D1, D5, and momentum, and the non-conserved dipole charges become Kaluza-Klein monopole D1, D5 brain charges. So these charges are the charges that arise from brains which have a world volume direction around the loop. So these are the non-conserved charges. So as I said, the standard description of, for example, the BMPV black hole at the microscopic level would be within the D1, D5 conformal field theory. So it's natural to ask whether we can also understand black rings this way. So to do that, we can take a decoupling limit of the black ring. We send alpha prime to zero. We take the decoupling limit of the BMPV solution. What that gives us is just ADS3 times S3 times the 4 torus locally. Globally, there are some identifications mixing up the 3 sphere and the ADS3, but locally it has this very simple structure. If we take the same decoupling limit for the black ring, it's much more complicated. So the decoupling limit of the black ring is no longer just some product of ADS3 and S3 and a 4 torus. It's some non-trivial 6 manifold times a 4 torus. And this 6 manifold only approaches ADS3 times S3 at infinity, so it's asymptotic to ADS3 times S3, as you would hope. And also down near the horizon, it's also asymptotic to ADS3 times S3. But these are not the same ADS3 times S3s. These are different radii in the two cases, and moreover, directions which are tangential to the 3 sphere at infinity, some of them end up tangential to the ADS3 at the horizon. So there's a very non-trivial interpolation between these two geometries, which is reminiscent of an RG flow. So now the natural question is, how do we use the D1, D5 CFT to calculate the entropy of black rings? And I think that's still a question that remains to be understood. I should mention also that I've been discussing the D1D5 CFT, but Benner and Krauss have suggested that maybe it would be more appropriate to use the CFT that describes four-dimensional supersymmetric black holes, which is the D1D5 KK monopole CFT. Essentially, the reason for that is that near the horizon, one finds that the solution is dominated by these monopoles, sorry, these dipoles. So maybe a description based on that would be more appropriate. Okay, so let me summarize. So BPS black rings are the first examples of BPS black holes of non-spherical topology, well, asymptotically flat black holes of non-spherical topology. They provide the first examples of black hole non-uniqueness at the supersymmetric level. I've explained how non-conserved dipole charges play an important role in understanding the microscopic structure of black rings. And this is going to be a common theme running through the rest of the talks this morning. And the main reason, of course, for interest in supersymmetric black rings is the question of whether we can calculate their entropy using string theory. As I've said, this is a much larger family of supersymmetric black holes in five dimensions than we had before. So we should be able to, if we can calculate their entropy, then that provides a much stronger test of string theory than we had before. So this is going to be discussed by David. A couple of open questions. Well, there are lots of open questions. I just mentioned two. One on the subject of black hole uniqueness at the supersymmetric level. So I mentioned my result that any supersymmetric black hole in five dimensions is either the BMPV solution or it's a black ring. To promote that to a full classification of BPS black holes, we'd have to prove that the black rings that we found are the only black rings. So if we could prove that, then we'd have a complete list of BPS black rings, and that would be nice. Sort of BPS black holes, and that would be nice. And then finally, as I've mentioned, there's this outstanding problem to understand black rings, and in particular to calculate their entropy using the D1-D5 conformal field theory. Essentially, the problem here is how do you input the information about dipole charges into the conformal field theory? You want to count presumably you want to count states which in some sense have the same dipole charges as the black ring. Traditionally, in entropy calculations, you know how to count states which have the same conserved charges as an object, but how do you put in this information about non-conserved charges? That seems to be something that isn't understood at the moment. So I'll stop there. Thank you. I don't think so, no. Well, I don't know about the supersymmetric case. I guess no, though. In the non-supersymmetric case, I'm pretty certain there isn't.
J psi has to be greater than J phi for these solutions. Can we take a limit where J psi approaches J phi?
Yes. Well, in some sense you can, in some sense you can't. In one sense, that limit gives you the BMPV black hole, but in a sense, that limit is somehow not really a very well-defined limit. It's kind of analogous to taking a limit in which you start off with, for example, a multiple Ryster-Nordström solution, and you try and take the limit in which two of the Ryster-Nordström black holes approach each other. Okay. You might say, well, that limit obviously gives me a larger Ryster-Nordström black hole, but in practice that limit's discontinuous because the area jumps discontinuously. It's kind of analogous to what happens here. Well, at first, that argument about balancing centrifugal and gravitational forces is, I mean, I've been giving talks using that argument for years, but I don't think it's a very convincing argument because it's essentially a Newtonian argument, and black holes are not very Newtonian objects. And also, if you use that argument in four dimensions, you'd conclude that black rings do exist in four dimensions when they don't. So you have to be careful with that argument. But my guess is that as you step up the dimensions, things just get more and more complicated. And I'd expect there to be lots, at the non-supersymmetric level, I'd expect there to be lots more black hole solutions out there remaining to be found.
And how about
in higher dimensions? Well, there are no known examples of asymptotically flat supersymmetric black holes in more than five dimensions. But I'm reluctant to conclude anything based on that because we've we've discovered a lot of surprises in recent years, and no one's really thought so carefully about the higher dimensional case. But the way that one could start to investigate that would be to try and use the same kind of methods as I used for this uniqueness classification. So you can classify the near horizon structure of black holes fairly easily. And if you can see that at the near horizon level, it's not possible for, say, a three-sphere topology to exist, then that would rule out the existence of such solutions. Yeah, that's the S1 of the ring.
Right, so is this one flat direction and point
guide? No, it's not. You can write ADS. So it's the same story as the reason why you can compactify a black string to get a black hole, a BPS black string to a BPS black hole. You can write ADS3 as a line bundle over ADS2, and you can compactify the fiber to get you a circle. But you can only do it for ADS3. You can't do it for any higher dimensional ADS. No, for the black ring. Is there a Euclidean section for the black ring? No. Well, the way we found the black ring was by an analytic continuation of the Kaluza-Klein C metric, and people looked fairly hard to find the Euclidean section for that solution without success. So I don't think there should be one for the black ring. Roberto and I spent some time looking for one, but we didn't come up with anything. So we're fairly convinced one doesn't exist—a real Euclidean section. Regular one.
More questions? Okay, if not.